delight she is. I'm just,
I mean, we knew it coming in, right? We had Jillian on the podcast before, mm-hmm. and it's still one of the top listened to episodes because the topic is so important and so, what's the word?
Needed.
Undertaught.
Yes. Yeah.
Needed because mm-hmm. it's undertaught when we're talking about your period, right? Yeah. So the last time we had Jillian on, it was all about what your cycle actually was,
yes.
teaching people, you know, what are the phases? What do you do to optimize each phase? And it was really one side of the coin, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was so more what's like textbook normal. That's that typical 28 days we hear about, the phases, what you should be eating and exercising and feeling and all those things. And this time we brought her back because we wanted to know, well, what's outside of that? Where is like the, in my head, I was seeing it as like a standard deviation type of situation. We've got our normal, but then we also have this like window where of deviations until it gets to a point where it's not normal. So we really broke it down today with Jillian to figure out what's it like in between those kind of like windows, and then where you get a hard line where you're like, this is a red flag.
That perfectly sums it up. And I will just add briefly, buckle up. Please don't be overwhelmed. If you need to
get your notebook out.
Get your notebook out. If you need to listen in sections, like do that.
Yeah.
But there, we really try to think of the most popular complaints that women have when experiencing an irregular period and how common these complaints are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us not realizing that it's not okay. It's not okay. There's a lot that you can do to help it, and really kind of understanding what it means.
Yeah.
And so that's really what Jillian, I think her like magic sauce is being able to break down really complex things and kind of say,
oh,
here
totally.
Is like silver platter, what I want you to do and why. And why, right?
Yes. And why.
So I think the notebook is a really good idea.
I do.
If you're listening to this on a walk, like pause and speech to text a note.
Yeah. Or make sure you come back to it. And I do want to make sure I say one thing, because we had a conversation about using medications in this episode, and I don't think any of us want it to come off as if we're saying don't use medications. Like, obviously you need to be comfortable, and nobody's shaming anybody for using medications. She was just, you'll see when you listen, but the point was more, you don't have to rely on them if you don't want to, I think was the
perfect
point.
No, you're exactly right. You guys know us well enough by now know that we're come as you are. But I know too, a lot of us don't want to have to depend on medication.
Yes.
It's not that medication is bad, but it's that it's solving a problem in a way that doesn't feel truly solved to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not to say, to your point, Meg, that that's everybody.
Right.
So if that rubs you the wrong way, don't just disregard. Take the medicine if that's what feels good to you.
Yep.
And if it doesn't, then enjoy this episode because it is going to light you up.
Yes. And here's Jillian. Jillian, I'm so happy to have you back on the show. Like our first episode that you did with us was just, it is still, I think, our second most popular episode, even.
Ooh.
And it's been almost a year since
I love that.
Maybe a little less than a year. But here we are back again. And I'm very excited to pick your brain again.
Yay. So, I'm so excited.
The last time that we had Jillian on, we were talking about, right, Meg, we were talking about cycles and kind of the normal cycle. I'm using huge quotes there. And how to optimize a normal cycle. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking, okay, well, that's only a portion of people.
Mm-hmm.
What about, I would argue, even the majority of women who have either what they know is an irregular cycle, or more importantly, don't know that what they're experiencing equates to an irregular cycle. We use this phrase a lot here, common, but not normal.
Yeah.
And I think that if we can kind of unfold a lot of things that fall into that category in this conversation, I think that we'll be doing it justice. So we're here to chat with Jillian again about irregular cycles. And what we're going to hope to do is identify some things that might raise some red flags for people mm-hmm. and say, oh, that's just always been my experience. Didn't know that was messed up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or even I would go so far as to say, to jump in, that maybe we could touch on some of the opposite too, like things that people are told are not normal, but maybe actually kind of are. Mm. Like, I'm curious because I have a very long cycle, but I mm-hmm. also have a history of PCOS. So I don't know. Am I normal now and this is just my normal, or am I still kind of dealing from the repercussions of PCOS? I don't know. So maybe yeah. today we'll crack the code.
Oh my God, Meg, really good point. Okay. Jillian, before we dive in, tell the people who you are and why we're talking to you about this.
Yeah. So I'm, Jillian Greaves. I'm a functional dietitian and women's health specialist based in Boston, Massachusetts. I have a private practice where I work with women one-on-one. So I am in the weeds, supporting a lot of women with exactly what we're talking about today in terms of investigating, period-related issues, hormone problems, and kind of getting to the bottom of, you know, what's going on and supporting those things with, you know, diet, lifestyle, supplements. So talking about periods and the menstrual cycle, this is sort of my jam. And I'm really excited to kind of have a different conversation today than we did the first time in terms of, you know, kind of helping women understand, you know, what is normal and maybe what isn't normal and kind of what to do with that information.
Yay. I love it. Yeah. So okay. So why don't we start right off the bat by kind of try, and this could be tricky, but let's try to define what would a quote normal menstrual cycle, generally speaking, look and feel. I think that's important, right? Look and feel mm-hmm. like. And then maybe draw a comparison to what you are seeing in your practice, or maybe even Meg, what you guys have both experienced perhaps in mm-hmm. terms of what is not regular or irregular or actually just painful or illness.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So great, you know, great kind of question and, you know, sort of a topic to kick off with in terms of what actually is normal. When people are talking about periods and menstrual cycles, oftentimes you will hear the number 28 referenced often in terms of, you know, 28-day cycle, which is considered an average menstrual cycle length. But, you know, that's not actually the case for most people in terms of, you know, getting, you know, their period every 28 days. And we do consider a normal cycle length really to be anything anywhere from 22 to 35 days. So anything within that kind of time frame can be normal. I think there's a little bit more to it in terms of if you have a shorter cycle or a longer cycle, you know, wanting to understand when are you ovulating, how long is the follicular phase, that first part of your cycle, how long is the luteal phase, that second part, you know, half of your cycle. But generally, you know, 22 to 35 days is considered normal. If our cycles are, you know, much shorter than that, if they're, you know, much longer than that with any regularity, then that's where, you know, we definitely want to ask some questions.
With any regularity, is that then suggesting that the random, either very short or very long cycle might not necessarily be something to worry about, but could just be an explanation for maybe you were sick, maybe there was a lot of stress, maybe there was something else off, and it's like, we'll kind of write that off as long as that's not the trend. Does that sound correct?
100%. And, you know, okay. we data's even found that, you know, healthy women of reproductive age have anywhere from 1 to 2 anovulatory cycles a year. That can happen from, you know, travel, illness, also, you know, stressful situations. And if there's a one-off kind of wonky cycle, certainly take note. And I would say, let's monitor what's happening in, you know, the future months. But if it's sort of a one-off thing and then the cycle kind of regulates and we're back, you know, to sort of a normal length cycle, then I wouldn't be, you know, concerned about it.
Okay.
Wow. That is okay. Just so crazy to think about. Cause like, let's just rule. Kylie mentioned a couple, but really quickly, just like, you know, talk about some of the things that can knock your cycle out of whack. Like it's Kylie mm-hmm. mentioned, like stress and travel or sleep or sickness, or like even mm-hmm. what you eat can knock it off. Like it's just so funny how fragile it is.
I know. And it's crazy. You know, travel across time, you know, time zones is a big mm-hmm. one where, you know, women will see disruption to their cycle and it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And again, it's good to pay attention to these things, but we also want to look at the context in terms of, okay, did I just, you know, travel, you know, home from California or from, you know, Europe? Am I in a really stressful, you know, kind of acute, you know, time in life right now in terms of maybe I got laid off, you know, from my mm-hmm. job and, mm-hmm. you know, finances are really stressful and there's a lot of acute, you know, stressors happening emotionally that could impact things. You know, maybe, you know, we got the flu or COVID or we're, you know, on a medication, you know, in a short-term sense that's disrupting the cycle. So definitely a lot of things, you know, that can contribute to some disruption there.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So let's take both ends of the spectrum in terms of length of time, and then we'll go on to some other variables. Mm-hmm. But if somebody has a very short, so shorter cycle than 22 days, or a very long, longer than 35 mm-hmm. days, what are some of the implications of that? So one, what might be a cause of that? Two, what could they kind of think about actually doing to help course correct? Mm-hmm. And three, what might that mean in terms of fertility or even comfort throughout their cycles?
Yeah. So great questions there. And I think the first thing I want to mention right off the bat is that definitely, you know, in terms of having a shorter cycle or a longer cycle and what that could mean, it's definitely very relevant and pertinent from a fertility perspective, if we're thinking about trying to conceive. But I do want to highlight the importance of just, you know, kind of understanding the cycle and any abnormalities outside of that. And I find that most women, and I don't, you know, this isn't always the case, but most often in the work that I'm doing with women, we're not always paying close attention until we're thinking about preconception or trying to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And I think mm-hmm. these are things that women should start tracking and just thinking about, you know, much, much earlier on, which is a whole different story in terms of, I think, you know, kind of the gaps in education that we talked about on the first episode.
Yeah.
But I think every woman should be tracking their cycle. And I cannot tell you how many times I, you know, get on a new call. This actually just happened today. I get on a new call with a client that, you know, has no clue, you know, how long their cycle is, what's going on with their period. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they have a period tracker app, but they're kind of using it here and there. And it's really kind of cool what we can gather, you know, about our health or kind of what suspicions we can kind of gather from, you know, monitoring things like just the length and how the period mm-hmm. is. So just want to mention that it's not just about fertility, definitely is more important, you know, for overall health. But to speak specifically to what you asked about, you know, long cycles and short cycles. So there's a lot of different things that, you know, could drive those dynamics, but I'll speak to kind of the most common things, which yeah. I think will be most helpful. Perfect. So if we have a really long cycle, you know, usually that means we have a very long follicular phase. So the follicular phase is that first half of the cycle that is most variable in length to begin with. But, you know, if cycles are really long, really irregular, usually it's because, you know, the follicular phase is stretched out. That is common with PCOS, like you mentioned, Meg, in terms of having those longer cycles. And most often when we have those really long cycles, I see it related to stress. So it could be emotional stress, it could be physical stressors, you know, that is delaying ovulation. So we're ovulating much later in the cycle. It could be related to estrogen deficiency or low estrogen. So it's taking a long time for estrogen to hit that peak that actually stimulates the LH surge and ovulation to occur, mm-hmm. Which could happen for a variety of reasons. But I mean, you know, low estrogen could also be a byproduct of chronic stress as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's actually some decent data too on just low vitamin D status actually in terms of, which is interesting. So those are kind of the common things, you know, that that I see in terms of, you know, why the follicular phase might be really long. Mm-hmm. So if you are someone that is experiencing really long, you know, cycles and you're like, man, my cycle is 36, 37, you know, 40 days long, then the first thing I would think about is, you know, what's kind of going in my on in my life, you know, emotionally with stressors. Mm-hmm. And then I would take it a step further to consider, you know, physical stressors. Am I eating enough? You know, oh. Right? You know,
that's not usually the question. Am I eating enough?
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that I see really, really commonly in practice with women where, you know, sometimes it's intentional, but oftentimes it's not, where mm-hmm. we're, you know, low grade under eating, taxing mm-hmm. the body and, you know, the body, you know, in order we need to feel safe in order to, you know, ovulate and, you know, for the body to feel safe for reproduction and to just like produce adequate amounts of sex hormones. So if we're under eating, even in a low grade sense over time, you know, that can disrupt that feeling of safety in the body and, you know, impact our cycle. So, you know, are we under eating? Are we getting very little sleep? Are we over exercising, which is another thing I'll see often where we're doing like, you know, 5-6 days a week of spinning and HIIT training and the body is just taxed. Yeah. So those are things that I would look at right off the bat in terms of, are there imbalances with stressors, physical stressors in particular, and, you know, how could I maybe support those things?
Wow. Okay. So a longer cycle typically means that you're ovulating later in your cycle and a longer follicular phase, which is the estrogen kind of building up. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Okay. And then what if it's a shorter? What does that mean?
Yeah. So if it's a shorter cycle, and again, there's a variety of things that could be going on here, but just to speak to like the most common things that we see, oftentimes that can be due to a short luteal phase. So that second half of the cycle is shorter. You know, the when it comes to the follicular phase, again, that's kind of the most variable piece of the cycle where there's a lot that can kind of be considered normal, really anywhere from like 7 to 21 days. So if you have a shorter cycle, but you're hitting that estrogen peak and you're, you know, ovulating consistently, that's a good thing. But if our luteal phase is short, that second half of the cycle, so if we're seeing a luteal phase that's, you know, lower than 12 days, really, ideally we want that to be 12 to 14 days. That you know could be impacting the overall length of the cycle. Most of the time, if that's happening, it is related to low progesterone. You know, which is something that I see often in practice, and also thyroid issues. I see that a lot as well.
Okay, and do you find that when you correct the thyroid, correct the sleep, correct the stressors, correct the eating, things have a way of balancing themselves out?
Yeah. You know, most often, yes. And it's pretty incredible. And I won't lie that it, you know, is an overnight transformation. Right. If we do identify that there's a short luteal phase and progesterone production is insufficient, I usually recommend, you know, kind of working on things with diet, lifestyle, supplements, whatever components are needed for like 3 to 6 months and really to allow the body time to adjust. So,
3 to 6 months.
It takes time, but it is 1000% possible. And, you know, sometimes it is more of the foundational things with the under eating, you know, the over exercising, you know, poor sleep, maybe, you know, stressful job, emotional stressors. And it can also be deeper rooted in terms of, you know, the thyroid dysfunction, nutrient deficiencies, other things that need to be supported there as well. But yeah, so those are kind of the most common reasons that we're seeing, you know, short cycles or long cycles.
I have a question just about the stress component, because I think probably in every episode we talk about stress in one way or another.
Yeah.
But I think that, so I think it's time to ask this question, is that like, I think we've all had worked with this client, and I'm sure a lot of our people listening could also see this in themselves, is how do, like, I'm not stressed. Like, how do I know? But yet they, do you know what I mean? Because I do it a lot of times where I'm just busy, but I'm not actively thinking I'm stressed. And so what do you think is a good approach for somebody? I guess what I'm saying is I think it's probably more known now that we're not always consciously aware of how stressed we are. Some of us, I think, are maybe even in denial. But if you are in the point where you're genuinely confused on if you are stressed often enough to where it's messing with your cycle, where do you suggest that somebody might start to like investigate that? And then maybe what are some things that you might suggest they do?
Yeah. And in terms of like where they would investigate to understand if stress was a factor?
Yeah.
That's such a great question. And, you know, to kind of echo what you're saying too, I think a lot of us are unaware, you know, myself included, this was a big part of my health journey in terms of not really understanding that my body was operating in a chronic sympathetic, you know, state. That's where I was living. And, I think a lot of us do get sort of stuck in that fight or flight mode, which is going to impact everything in the body, but we've sort of adapted to that being the norm. So if that is the case where it's like, man, I don't feel stressed, but I've identified that I, you know, have a short luteal phase and I'm kind of concerned about, you know, things impacting that and progesterone production. First, I would actually try to just outwardly evaluate habits in terms of like what's going on and can we identify, say, any of those physical stressors that are impacting the body. And maybe that means, you know, just for an entire week, you're tracking what's happening with sleep. Like how many hours of sleep am I logging? Am I getting, you know, good quality sleep where I'm not waking throughout the night, or am I, you know, getting really disrupted sleep? That's a stressor. You know, maybe I'm going to do a little bit of food tracking for, you know, the week in Chronometer and get a sense of, you know, am I eating enough? Am I under eating calories? Am I under eating protein? Am I under eating carbs, which I see a lot with, you know, women of reproductive age. So maybe just getting an outward pulse on like, you know, gathering some data about yourself, essentially, if you feel like it's, you know, you're not feeling stressed. So you could assess those habits, you know, right off the bat. And then, you know, there's ways to investigate more deeply. I do a lot of, you know, Dutch hormone testing with clients, where we're actually looking at cortisol and measuring cortisol, which often is very, very eye-opening for clients and just validating in terms of like, man, I didn't realize that my body was experiencing this, or, you know, I had a different perception of what was going on. So sometimes actual data is validating. If you don't have access to, you know, completing a Dutch test, or it's not in, you know, the budget for you, there's all sorts of different, you know, kind of trackers and things, which also would be an investment, but I guess it'd be a longer term investment in terms of things like an Oura Ring, right? Where, you know, you can monitor, you know, things like your HRV or your heart rate variability, which can give you some indications of what's happening with the, you know, the autonomic nervous system. I'll be honest, when I, you know, many years ago, when I was going through my kind of health journey, I wore, you know, an actual heart rate monitor and measured my heart rate variability for three full days. And I was very surprised to learn, you know, that I had like no recovery time during the day. You know, I'm
Science
and I'm having a ball all day. I think
how much
great.
Is a heart rate monitor? I'm going to the store right after we get off. Right? I'm forgetting the
name of the company. But I used to have an office in a chiropractor's office, and they had like a subscription to heart rate monitor, which measures, you know, really accurately measures the heart rate variability. So they had, you know, had it at the office, and I was like, oh, I'm going to try this. And and then in looking at the data, it's like, wow, I'm operating, you know, in that fight or flight state all day. Running on cortisol. But it was you know, really eye-opening for me. So there's, you know, Oura Rings and different devices, that you can wear that can help give some insights there. And, you know, and it doesn't mean that if you identify, you know, oh, wow, I am operating, you know, more so in that sympathetic state, it doesn't mean, you know, you're going to like, you know, quit your job or, you know, you need to meditate for hours and hours a day. And there can be really small things that you can do, to kind of shift what's going on. And again, just use myself as an example. When I was, you know, kind of identifying that stress was such a big factor for me. I, you know, started incorporating small chunks of either like 2 minutes of breath work or like a 5 minute guided meditation during the workday. And
wow, that's yeah, it.
And it helped.
Yeah. And you know, that's where I started. And now, you know, I have a more, you know, kind of robust nervous system, you know, support plan. But, you know, starting out, it was, I actually would see the difference in terms of like, wow. Oh, I'm in the red here all day. And then, wow, I got, you know, this recovery for 2 minutes, 5 minutes. Oh, now I'm going to incorporate another bout of that. And then,
wow.
You know,
oh, man.
Yeah. So it's like those small outlets of recovery that you can create for the nervous system, you know, and even if it's just like, you know, checking in with your body and assessing like, all right, you know, are my shoulders up to my ears? Am I breathing, mm-hmm. you know, from my chest? Can I like, you know, bring mm-hmm. my shoulders down, take a few slow controlled breaths? And I think when we can do those things consistently, it can help to shift what's happening with the nervous system, you know, for a lot of people. But
wow. I just want to highlight that what you just said is that you went from being in a state, like having hard objective evidence of living in the fight or flight state, which you didn't mm-hmm. even know, it doesn't sound mm-hmm. like, consciously, and then just you were able to see again the hard objective data. 2 minutes is mm-hmm. all it took to start with, mm-hmm. and I didn't mean to like you know side detour us our conversation, but I just think it's so important. And this for me at least, and I'm sure for a lot of listeners, mm-hmm. everything you just said has been so helpful. And I'm gonna go get me a heart rate.
Meg, I think it was a really important segue, honestly, because this is the actionable component that we're looking for. And just to tie this all together, like, you know, Jillian's talking to us about how to identify being stressed and then what to maybe do about it. But mm-hmm. connect that back to what we were really talking about is that has an impact. So if you're one of these people that has a really short or a really long, or maybe we're going to go into some of the other symptoms mm-hmm. and you're looking at this and this is a mirror for you and you're saying, oh, holy shit, didn't mm-hmm. know that wasn't okay. This is me right there. 2 minutes. If you can't afford 2 minutes, then, you know, take a hard look, my friend, because I think you'll find it. I really do.
Yeah.
So, okay, I would love to also talk about the physical symptoms. So mm-hmm. cramping, pain, mood, the bloating, please let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And acne, I mean, all of these components, mm-hmm. I would love to know how much of this is actually an appropriate expression of the natural shift and change that's happening every month. And kind of, I know there is no like hard line because everybody's so different, but mm-hmm. I'd love to know what can we offer people as sort of like the final red flag for like, this is a sign that something is kind of off. Yeah. So start with whichever variable you feel most excited about.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You know, and I get excited about all these things clearly, but, you know, I would say in general, you know, with all of those things that you just mentioned before we kind of dive into the weeds with all of those things, subtle shifts, which we talked about a little on the first, you know, episode, but just to reiterate, subtle shifts that you observe are normal. The body is going through a lot with these cyclical shifts and with hormones changing. So if you observe, you know, some, you know, subtle shifts with mood, you know, that can be normal. If you're observing that you're feeling a little bit, you know, more tired and introverted, that can be totally normal. Or if there's a little, you know, kind of breakout here or there. If we're experiencing, you know, significant shifts with mood, we're fatigued, you know, we're getting chronic, you know, breakouts at certain times in the cycle. You know, if we're, you know, experiencing period cramping, you know, and discomfort that is actually, you know, disruptive to our day to day, or it's requiring, you know, taking a medication or something like that. Those would all be red flags for me in terms of subtle shifts are normal, but if we're experiencing, you know, really outward disruptive symptoms, that is not normal. And those are kind of the SOS signals from, you know, the body that we had talked a little bit about or mentioned on the first episode.
Can I ask you to clarify? Because I just heard if you need to take medication. So are you even talking about like if you need to take ibuprofen for like day one of your, really?
Yes, 100%.
Whoa. Oh,
Meg's like, oops.
I need the period doctor. I'm on day one right now. I'm sitting here with a heating pad.
I was just going to say, should people need a heating pad? I can't believe you did that, Meg. Yeah.
I also took ibuprofen before this because I knew we'd be laughing a lot and I didn't want to like... Anyway, go on.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. So it's really my feeling that if there's any, Advil, anything like that needed, that's not normal. So that's giving us, you know, some important information. I will say though, just as a side note, and I actually posted about this on Instagram last week, there are some, little interesting, clinical studies that have been done comparing supplemental ginger to different NSAIDs for, period cramps. And it's been found that 250 to 500 milligrams, ginger rhizome is as effective as NSAIDs at, reducing period pain, but obviously without the, negative implications. So
lots of powerful. So are we talking in a capsule form where these studies done, or was it tea or it was capsules?
Capsule. And you could use it like a tincture too. Definitely, obviously eating ginger or utilizing ginger juice, things like that can be helpful. But typically I will have women keep, encapsulated ginger in their, natural medicine cabinet, or some type of a blend in terms of something that has like, some cramp bark, magnesium, B6, and ginger all in one. And across the board, it's been found that, again, the ginger is as effective as NSAIDs, and it's even more helpful if you start it proactively in terms of, okay, I'm going to get my period in the next couple days. So I'm going to start, increasing that anti-inflammatory and the ginger. And the cool thing is, and I guess this kind of brings us into talking about the period cramp specifically, but the two reasons that I will usually see people having, painful periods are the overproduction of prostaglandins. Mm-hmm. So prostaglandins being those inflammatory molecules that the body produces in high amounts, pre-period and during our period, causes the uterus to contract, shed its lining, mm-hmm. And that's, the bleed.
And there's nothing we can or want to do about that. That's intended. That's all good. They're supposed to come up.
Yes, 100%. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. So we are supposed to, whenever we say inflammation, we always, I think some, sometimes because of the way we talk about it, it sounds so negative, but it's actually a very, essential, necessary process. So thank you for pointing that out. So yes, we're supposed to produce the prostaglandins. That's their job, is to help us shed that uterine lining if, conception doesn't, mm-hmm. occur. Mm-hmm. But what can happen is we have the overproduction of prostaglandins because there's other things driving inflammation in the body. Mm-hmm. And the way that ginger works is that it actually disrupts or impacts prostaglandins. So that is the mechanism.
Food is so cool.
Right? That's like the mechanism for, for which it's, lowering pain and inflammation. And that's why it's, ginger, there's like some good studies in terms of like rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, different things. So yeah, pretty cool. So it can be, the overproduction of prostaglandins, and the approach I always take is like, okay, we want you comfortable in an immediate sense. So like, let's, use the ginger or get some tools in our toolkit. And then let's figure out why we're overproducing, the prostaglandins or why there's more inflammation, kind of driving these things. So prostaglandins is one piece of things. And then issues with estrogen is another reason that, typically excess estrogen or too much estrogen in relation to progesterone, that can also contribute to, more period cramping because, estrogen is what is causing that uterine lining, to thicken. So if we have a ton of estrogen, we're going to have more uterine lining to shed. So that can create some pain as well.
Wow. So what I think a question that I get often, and I'm not up to date on the research, so I'd love to know what you think, is like, what are your thoughts on if you suspect that somebody does have too much estrogen, what is your recommendation for them on like phytoestrogenic foods? Like, are you, do you, if there is any, I don't know. I'm just, yeah. It's just random question.
Yeah. So, and that's like, no, not random at all. I feel like that's such a like controversial, like,
yeah,
people are so like,
I'm throwing you into the ringer.
Yeah. It's like, oh my gosh, people are going to be mad.
Will
at
you
me, but
also tell us what a phytoestrogenic food is for people who don't know?
Yes. Thank you, Kylie. Yes.
Yeah. So, a phytoestrogen is a plant estrogen. So there are certain plant foods that, you know, act like estrogen essentially in the body, but they are very weak estrogens. And whenever, you know, I bring up the idea that, you know, something is estrogen and bringing estrogen into the body, people do, they like freak out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can feel scary. And, you know, estrogen or phytoestrogen, you know, containing food. So like your soy products and flaxseed and things like that, you know, the way that these things have been studied is so mixed that it's just created a little bit of chaos. But ultimately, based off the data we do have, and this is, you know, just my evaluation and how I approach things, when it comes to phytoestrogens, they're kind of like estrogen adaptogens. So if you are someone that is struggling with high estrogen, it's possible, you know, based off kind of the again, my evaluation of the data, that when we include these weak plant estrogens, that they can replace, they interact with estrogen receptors and can essentially replace some of those more potent estrogens that are causing issues. Yeah. If we have low levels of estrogen, it can be helpful to introduce, you know, some of those weak phytoestrogens. So at the end of the day, I think that, you know, for a variety of estrogen issues, incorporating some phytoestrogens into the diet can be helpful. You know, ground flaxseed is definitely a favorite, you know, that I'll recommend. Not everyone does, you know, well with soy, but, you know, I feel that if someone likes soy, they don't have a problem with it. You know, that can be a great thing to incorporate as well. And I just kind of recommend focusing on, you know, the, more whole food forms or less processed, you know, edamame, tofu, tempeh, trying to find organic if you're able to. Yeah. But yeah, I'm all for it in terms of, cool. you know, bringing those in.
Cool. Thank you for that. I was just curious.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Okay. So we've talked about length of cycle, normal things, red flags. We've talked about pain, normal pain, not okay pain, Meg.
I got a whole thing of ginger in my fridge. I'm going to go.
Meg's taking notes.
I am. I have a list of chores to do when we're done with this interview.
I love
that. Oh my God. Let's talk about bloating next, because I know and I imagine that some level of that is somewhat unavoidable just with the changes and fluctuations that are happening. But maybe explain what causes that bloating and when it's crossing a line into not normal.
Yeah. So, so definitely a little bit of bloating can be normal, particularly in the luteal phase and later on in the luteal phase, like, you know, a week or so before your period. And usually that is related to the hormone progesterone that we're producing at that time, which actually does cause some fluid retention. So we may notice, you know, some more bloating. We may notice, you know, feeling a little bit, you know, for lack of a better word, I don't want to say like swollen, but kind of just in terms of, okay, you know, there's a little bit of extra fluid in a very,
well, again, I relate very to swollen. Way. I relate to swollen.
Yeah, swollen.
That feels right.
I believe full on marshmallow mode would be appropriate.
Do you guys have certain pants that you've saved during the month to make sure that they are clean for this particular week? Because they're like, just the same way that there are other pants that only get worn at other parts of the cycle. Like, there's no way those are going on the week before my period. Like, it's not comfortable. It's not flattering. Nobody wins, right? But then there are other ones that look sloppy and messy when you're feeling a little sassier and okay.
100%. 100%.
So yes, swollen, it feels right.
I love that.
That's oh so my funny. God. Okay. As you were.
Yeah. So a little bit of that in a subtle way is so, you know, is so normal. You know, you might actually notice too, and I'm not, you know, really an advocate for, people like weighing themselves at all. But if you're someone that that does weigh yourself, you might notice your weight goes up, you know, in the luteal phase. And that's also very normal, you know, for things to ebb and flow like that. But typically it's that it's the progesterone that's causing some of that fluid retention. And then in terms of, you know, kind of bloating, and this also kind of gets into the bowel movement piece of things too, is that, progesterone, you know, causes the fluid retention, but it also causes a smooth muscle to relax. So it slows down peristalsis. So, food is moving more slowly through the, you know, digestive tract, and we can end up feeling a little bit more, you know, on the constipated end of the spectrum. We should all, you know, ideally always be having daily bowel movements. But if you notice some of those shifts, it's usually related to progesterone. So if it's like, okay, more fluid, things are slowing down, you can kind of understand why we might feel a little bit swollen.
Okay. And what can help that? Just in the like normal sense, let's say it's nothing super crazy and it's like that normal kind of impact from that rise. And so is it like drinking water? Is it taking something? Is it, there's nothing you could do? What do you think?
Yeah, no, definitely things that you can do. So magnesium is one of my favorites in terms of, you know, magnesium can be really helpful. Generally just, you know, fluid and some mineral support. So your sodium, magnesium, potassium can be super helpful. You know, during that time. And I would say, you know, in, there's some things that I think I see almost to speak to it through a different lens. I see some things happening that, that contribute to making it worse in terms of, you know, doing a whole bunch of, you know, super high intensity movement, you know, the week before our period where we're already kind of, you know, swollen and, you know, the, you know, things are, aren't moving as quickly through the digestive tract. And then we're like jacking up cortisol, you know, with our high intensity movement or, so I think it's often too, what I see is the things that women are kind of, like pounding their body with almost, you know, and that can create more, more amplification with these symptoms, if that makes sense. But yeah, I would say, you know, fluid, mineral support, magnesium is really great. You know, certainly if you feel like you're someone that does, you know, notice a bit more bloat and things really slowing down with the, you know, the digestive tract, incorporating, you know, natural prokinetics. So our ginger, you know, things like ginger again, you know, some digestive bitters, things that are just like, you know, gently stimulating to kind of support what's going on.
Wonderful. Okay.
I just have one question about the clarification of, to clarify the mineral support and the magnesium. Are you... is that support you can get through food? Like, are you talking about like high magnesium foods and maybe some, I don't know, like coconut water or I think you're the fan, you're the one who's the fan of Bamba Root, right?
Bamba Root. Yeah.
We have a very funny story to tell you, by the way, about that, but,
I can't wait.
But, yes. Yeah, so, or is it something like some kind of mineral mix?
Yeah. So definitely. I always like the food first approach in terms of, you know, highlighting more foods rich in those specific minerals, which is wonderful and can be super impactful. I do think particularly with something like magnesium, it's, easier, to get, you know, more kind of therapeutic doses through a supplement, you know, a powder or a capsule. So that's usually my recommendation, particularly with magnesium. Potassium, I feel, is a little bit easier to, you know, to get through foods in higher amounts. So that's something we could emphasize, you know, and sodium more so through food sources. You know, but you can do a Bumble Root or a you know, mineral beverage as well.
Yeah. So really quickly, I went and got the Bumble Root but it took a long time to ship, and I got some, my intention was when I got it, I was going to split the package and send some to Kylie.
Yeah.
So, but it took so long. It took forever. So
remember that Meg lives in Hawaii, everyone. Yeah. So Meg is in Hawaii. I'm in DC. It takes forever for it to get to Meg.
Oh man. I don't know why I thought that way. I don't know why I didn't just send one to you and one to me. I don't know why I didn't do that. But anyway.
Well, because you wanted to try it and see. Do we like it?
Yes. That's exactly it. So anyway, I got it finally. I sent off to Kylie and I'm like all excited. I'm like, Kylie, I sent you something. It's a surprise. I can't wait for you to get it. She texts me when she gets it and she goes, Meg, did you send me an empty box? And I'm like, what? Like, no, I didn't send you an empty box. So
I got the envelope and I opened it. It was totally nothing in it. I'm like, you shouldn't have. You really shouldn't have.
Gee, dang.
I don't know what happened to it.
Happened to it.
It happened here too. Some USPS worker was really curious about Bumble Root and decided wanted to take it.
They're very hydrated. I hope they're hydrated. Okay. I
mean, clearly they're in high demand. Someone else is waiting for their Bumble Root and they're like, man, I'm taking hers.
Yeah. Honey.
That person's menstrual bloating is under control. we can all feel rest assured that person's PMS bloating is under control.
Oh my god.
So good.
At the expense of Kylie's package of Bumble Root.
Unbelievable.
It's so good.
Anyway, sorry to divert with that. I had to.
No, that was important.
That was a must share. So
it was.
I forgot about that until you just mentioned it right now. Yeah. Oh my god.
I have not forgotten about it. I had a vendetta against the postal service.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my god.
Anyway,
that's so good.
Okay. So share with us when the bloating is not okay, because there's a little bit is going to happen. We now understand why and some things we can do to help mitigate it. For some people, even if they do all of those things, it's not touching it and they're starting to take over-the-counter medications to try to help.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cause of that potentially, and why is it not okay?
Yeah, so in terms of the cause of like really significant bloating, that's cyclical. Most commonly, I'm going to see that related to issues with the balance of estrogen to progesterone in that luteal phase. So most often, you know, it's going to be an general excess estrogen situation, or an issue with, metabolizing estrogen, which is also something, if that's the case, you may also notice that there's a lot of bloating pre-period, maybe also around ovulation, and you may experience, some pain with periods and even heavier bleeding. So, you don't have to kind of hit on all of those things to have an issue with estrogen, but that's what I will see commonly. If you are experiencing bloating that is not subtle in terms of like, oh, I'm noticing just like a little bit of subtle bloating here. If it's like, man, I can't button my pants. Look like I'm super distended. I'll have clients say I look, 4 months pregnant, for this period of my cycle and like right around ovulation. So those would be indicators that there's some type of an imbalance, that is driving that.
Mm. And typically that's an imbalance in estrogen to progesterone.
Yep.
Okay. We've talked a lot about estrogen. What could be a cause? And we don't have to go down the rabbit hole, but a couple causes of high estrogen.
Yeah. So in terms of high estrogen, with overproducing estrogen, and I will say I do see this a good amount. And I don't always feel that there's one, kind of root cause, but to kind of list, kind of rattle off a few things, endocrine disruptors or estrogen mimicking chemicals in the environment that can actually contribute to high estrogen in the body. Issues with estrogen breakdown or detoxification, predominantly in the liver, that can create an excess estrogen situation. And that could mean, there's some genetic components that are interfering with that. Oftentimes it means, the body, the liver doesn't have enough of what it needs to actually metabolize estrogen well in terms of like, amino acids and B vitamins and magnesium and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, gut issues, that's another, big one. So, maybe there is a constipation situation, which is, an actual gut symptom or digestive health symptom, but estrogen is predominantly eliminated via stool. So if we're not having, the 1 to 3 bowel movements daily, we can assume that there's probably some things going on with estrogen because our body can recirculate those estrogen waste products.
Wow.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What about acne then? And I'm kind of going down this list because I know that there's a lot of like interconnecting and a lot of people have a lot of these symptoms. And so kind of, I'm hoping that a lot of what you're saying is overlapping, and I'm hoping people 100%. Are hearing repeated things over and over so that they can say, okay, I feel like I've got all of this going on, but really it's because of these one or two things that I can address in these one or two ways, right? That's what I'm hoping you guys are putting together here.
and it really, it's, you know, all of these things are interconnected, and there is so much overlap with all of these different dynamics we're talking through. A lot of what, you know, the recommended, you know, kind of starting points are the same, or similar. And then, you know, there could be deeper investigative work needed, but, for acne in particular, and I know Meg is the acne expert here, but to speak, you know, just to the, you know, hormone pieces here, most common reasons that, I will see, you know, hormonal acne is related to issues with, androgens, which is a category of hormones that, you know, we all have. The most well-known androgen is testosterone. I think people can kind of probably relate to that. But there's a variety of different androgens. And if we have too many androgens, or there are some issues with how we're processing and metabolizing androgens, that can drive acne, particularly when testosterone is turned into a very potent testosterone metabolite, called DHT, or an enzyme turns, testosterone into this, you know, androgenic DHT that is like pretty well correlated with acne, usually cystic acne. So issues with androgens are problematic. And then also what we just talked about in terms of issues with estrogen, can drive, acne as well. Usually if there is the androgenic acne, and I don't know, I'd be curious to hear what you think too, Meg, but when there's androgenic acne, I really see this type of acne persistent most of the cycle. You know, there could be little ebbs and flows, but it's pretty constant. And usually because of that metabolite that I mentioned, and, you know, being kind of driven up by like blood sugar issues, inflammation, stress, if the hormonal acne is more estrogen driven, related to like too much estrogen or not enough progesterone in relation to estrogen, I'm seeing some cyclical flares in terms of, okay, we're breaking out like just pre-period, you know, that week before the acne is like raging, or it's like flaring around ovulation when estrogen is high, and then it's flaring in the luteal phase when it's high. So there's often some patterns there.
Is that what you see as well, Meg? Or what do you, if anything, feel like adding?
Yeah,
no, I've got like the two perfect people in my palms right now. This is great.
I agree. And I the only thing I'll add is that I have seen clients who break out consistently around ovulation and before their period, but it's more because that like your testosterone may peak at ovulation, and then at the end it's still consistent while the rest are lowering down the estrogen and progesterone. So I think it might depend on when in the luteal phase you are breaking out, if it's like closer to the end of your period or even in the beginning of your period when your estrogen and progesterone are coming down or are lower. It's especially for those people, I call it like the Hulk testosterone, those people who are making that stronger version when those other hormones are lower, your body's responding as if like the only raging hormone is testosterone, but it might be normal. It's just strong. So, but yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's see. Wow. We went over
a lot.
I know.
You know, let me ask this just to round out that acne piece. Is acne, is there any level of it that you would consider a normal response? Or would you kind of take that as, well, no, there's either an imbalance or a stressor or a genetic something that's not clearing or breaking or overproducing, or would you say at some point there is a little bit here and there that would be considered acceptable?
Yeah. So, and I'll, again, I know Meg's the acne expert here, but just in my,
we're asking you because we want to know what you have to, from your perspective. Yeah.
So from my perspective, I do feel that, having a little breakout here or there can be totally normal, in terms of like, okay, you know, breaking out with a zit here or there, if there's, you know, we're getting like, you know, eruptions with our skin, or it's like, okay, every time, you know, at this point in my cycle, I'm, you know, getting a bunch of acne in this place or that place. That's what I would say is not normal, but you know, we're not robots. And there's so many things that can contribute to, you know, acne or breakouts, you know, increased sebum production. It's like, you know, stress and insulin and all these different things that I think that, you know, that can be fairly normal in my opinion, you know, if it's a here and there thing, you know, if it's really disruptive, persistent, you know, that's where I want to dive a little bit deeper.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, okay. My brain is tired. That was so wonderful. We really kind of unloaded on you guys today, and I did it by design. I really did, because I know everybody's got such a unique experience with their cycle, and it is something like we talked about in our first episode with Jillian that is not talked about. It's not taught. And so you're already out there floating around and like not understanding the women who come before us, who are so in so many ways, our teachers and our guides and instructors have also not been taught. And so it's really just this insane thing. And my hope is that you heard little bits and pieces. My hope is that you saw your own experience in some of what Jillian was talking about today to be able to organize some type of plan to put into play for yourselves. Mm-hmm. And then if that plan doesn't work and you need more guidance, having an understanding of what those next steps might look like. And actually, maybe we can round out our conversation that way. And just by saying, okay, if this stuff is not doing it for you, what are some potential, and you could give a super brief overview, Jillian, but some potential either tests or types of practitioners that you might consider, or like who is the professional to look for?
Yeah. Great question. And I think to, you know, we did definitely cover a lot of ground today. And I think just also to kind of wrap things up with next steps for people in general. You know, if you're listening to this and you're like, I don't know what's going on with my cycle, or I experienced this or that, start tracking your cycle, you know, just be observational, you know, check in on sleep, you know, focus on nourishment in terms of, you know, consistent eating, making sure you're taking in enough food, that there's a good balance with exercise. You know, don't overlook those fundamentals, because I think if you, you know, when we talk about these things, if you hear, okay, you know, this symptom or that symptom that you relate to, I think sometimes we can think, oh my God, I have this hormone imbalance, I need testing, I need this and that. And, you know, maybe that's the case down the line, but there's a lot that you can focus on first that actually may resolve what's going on. So pay attention to the cycle, focus on those fundamentals, and give it a little bit of time. Give yourself a few months and sort of see how the dust settles and what you notice. And if you are still experiencing abnormalities with cycle length, or you're experiencing, you know, disruptive cyclical symptoms, that would be a time to, you know, connect with your provider to, you know, do a little bit of deeper investigative work. You know, and it definitely depends on the provider, but in my experience, a lot of times, you know, general PCPs and things like that just aren't super well versed in women's health and female physiology and all of that. So ideally, finding someone that is you know, in the women's health space would be great.
A Jillian.
I'm like, you know, obviously I'm partial to, you know, functional dietitians, because, you know, I think we're the greatest, to reach out to, but yeah, someone that's trained in women's health and can kind of, help you make sure the foundations are in a good place, and then maybe do some deeper testing with looking at, you know, estrogen and progesterone, testosterone, blood sugar, cortisol, things like that.
Awesome.
Wow.
Any courses or programs that you want to let our listeners know about going on right now? And also, if you could tell us where people can find you on social.
Yeah. So I have a couple things going on. One, I have my private practice where I'm seeing clients, and I have my co-dietitian, Courtney, who's also seeing clients in our practice. And then I have a course, a self-paced course that you can get anytime, called Eat to Heal Your PCOS, Nutrition Fundamentals for PCOS. And then I have a group program, a 12-week group coaching program, the Empowered PCOS program. you can find info about all of the above on, you know, my website, jilliangreaves.com. And you can follow me over on Instagram, at jilliangreavesrd, if you want to connect.
Cool. And we'll have all those in the show notes for sure.
Jillian! Awesome.
Yay, thank you so much.
We just love you. Thank you. Oh, you guys, also what you will find in all of that is that Jillian co-hosts her own podcast now.
Yes. Oh,
well,
my God.
Yes. Yeah. I want to support that. Tell us what the name of it is and who you do it with.
Yeah. So my colleague and really dear friend, Abby Huber, who's also a functional dietitian, she's a gut health specialist in Boston. We started a podcast together. It's called Your Body Has Your Back.
I love that name. Oh my God. It's perfect.
Right?
So
new podcast, and we're, talking about all things gut health and hormones over on Your Body Has Your Back.
I'm subscribing right now.
Subscribe. I love it. Yep. I love it. Mm-hmm. Jillian, thank you for your time, for your love, and for your contribution to teaching us about our own fucking body. It's crazy that it's such a need. So we love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing.
As always.
Yes, we love you. Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Curious Women. If you love our show, you can support us by leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And if you know someone else who would really love our show, please share it with them too.